from WAMU 88.5 at American University in Washington. Welcome to the Politics Hour, starring Tom Sherwood. I'm Kojo Nandi. Tom Sherwood, he is our resident analyst and a contributing writer to Washington City Paper. Tom Sherwood, welcome.
Good afternoon.
Later in the broadcast, we'll be talking with Carrie Delaney. She represents Fairfax and Loudoun County in Virginia's House of Delegates. Joining us in studio now is Mark Elrich. He is the executive of Montgomery County. Mark Elrich, welcome. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Before we get to Maryland and Mark Elrich, Tom Sherwood, Jack Evans apparently has made an announcement. He will no longer be doing any outside consulting and legal work. There are actually three pieces of news about Jack Evans, that one coming from he himself. The former campaign chair for Jack Evans' candidacy in Ward 2, Patrick Kennedy, says he's going to challenge Evans in the 2020 Democratic primary. And it is my understanding that a new recall petition has been filed to get Jack Evans out of office before the next election, to have a special recall, special election to get him out of office. What do you know about all of this?
Too much. But yes, yesterday the group of people that are trying to have a recall election filed new paperwork today, which won't be approved until the month of May by the Board of Elections. If then their first effort got caught up in some paperwork and some questions about the residency of one of the leaders. But anyway, they filed the new paperwork today, and so maybe in May we'll have the Board of Elections will allow them to spend the next 6 months getting about 5,200 signatures in Ward 2 to hold a special election. It could be late this year or early next year to have that election. And we have a primary. Jack Evans will be up for re-election next year. He has said in the past that he would not do outside work. He has an LLC, which is named after his late wife, for which he does legal work. Not lobbying work, but legal work. He says, and he had said that he would not do any of that anymore. He reiterated that this week talking to the ANC and DuPont Circle. So we're moving along with all this. We still don't have any resolution of the investigation into whether or not he used his office for personal gain, but we'll see that as it plays out.
How important is it that Mayor Muriel Bowser has appointed a new head of the Department of Behavioral Health, Barbara Bazron, who will be leading the department?
Well, she was there before, and then she went out, I think, to the state of Maryland, yes, for behavioral health, mental health issues, and now she's back. That office has had a great deal of trouble in dealing with the OxyContin crisis in the city and other matters, and it's just been poorly run, and the mayor thinks that she can come back and help run it. She was there once before when it was troubled, and it kind of calmed down, and now she's coming back.
Maryland's legislative session ended this past week, and joining us in studio now is Dominique Maria Bonessi. She's WAMU's Maryland reporter. Dominique, thank you for joining us.
Thanks, Kojo.
Well, the legislative session concluded this week. Any particularly dramatic showdowns on the final day of debate?
Right. So two big showdowns, the prescription drug affordability bill and the clean energy jobs bill. These were both very last-minute arguments on first for prescription drug affordability. It's one of the first of its kind in the country to create a board to reduce the cost of prescription drugs. It'd be a 5-member board that would determine upper payment limits and other options to reduce costs. They had the responsibility for studying the issue and advising legislation on how to move forward for 2020. The bill was originally watered down. It's been watered down from what it originally was, which was the intent to reduce prescription drugs for all Marylanders. But, you know, to get moderates on board and others on board, it would require, you know, a little give and take there. And then the clean energy jobs bill, you know, we had this bill essentially increases the state's renewable energy portfolio from 25% by 2020 to 50% by 2030. Renewable energy sources include wind, solar, nuclear. It also includes trash incinerators, which are not actually clean energy, but they're looking to phase those out in many parts of the state. So eventually we won't be seeing those as under clean energy jobs.
Any less contentious bills, but were nevertheless highly anticipated?
Right. Highly anticipated. I mean, source of tax revenue for the 10-year rollout of the Kerwin Commission that was in the which was in the blueprint for Maryland Public Schools bill. We also saw increased regulation on a medical marijuana industry. And, you know, another bill which also supported that was the sale of edible cannabis products. And we also saw protections for furloughed workers during federal government shutdowns, like the one we saw in January, which is going to be helping them with loans during a federal government shutdown that they'd be able to take out from the Maryland Department of Labor and then be paid back, of course.
Did the death of House Speaker Michael Bush change any last-minute decisions by the legislature?
You know, I didn't see any major changes. We do know that on that Monday, the Senate did override the veto of the oyster sanctuaries. Right. Those five oyster sanctuaries would be not allowed to be harvested on.
The big issue that Bush had been saying, we got to save the oysters.
And that was his bill.
Banning any harvesting.
Yeah.
Okay. What about, you know, all the politics is going on about who is going to be the next speaker. The House Democratic Caucus has to call a meeting and there has to be a special session. The funeral for the speaker is not until Tuesday. Mm-hmm. I know a lot of action may wait till then, but people are talking. Any thoughts about that?
Right. We know, well, Speaker Pro Tem Adrienne Jones from Baltimore County has already thrown her hat into the ring. And we also know that potentially possible front runners in this candidacy might be Maggie McIntosh from Baltimore City. She's chair of the House Appropriations right. Committee. And Derek Davis, yes.
From Prince George's,
who chairs the Economic Matters Committee. And these, you know, you got to think of his legacy. I mean, what the Speaker of the House did was pave the way for these people. He put them in positions in committees and subcommittees, but sometimes they felt that maybe they weren't ready, and he pushed them to lead. And
it's back in the early 2000s he did this.
Yes, and yeah. I mean, that's what Adrienne Jones said just Monday when, you know, she was in the Senate with her New Balance sneakers on, talking about the Speaker, and so that's something that he left behind that we're going to see a change in the House this year.
We will have, for the first time probably, we are going to have someone other than a white male as
exactly.
head of the House.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
House Speaker Mike Bush passed on Sunday at the age of 72. You just heard a little bit about the kind of legacy he left behind. How was he generally viewed among his colleagues?
Right. So Adrienne Jones, you know, called in other lawmakers. We saw Senator Sarah Elfriff in the Senate saying, you know, he was a coach, mentor, teacher. Elfriff said, you know, she would not have been in that position in the Senate had it not been for the Speaker's guidance and mentorship. And he's also seen as, you know, a friend to many in the House. You know, his staff, they could barely speak on Monday when I asked them, you know, you have any thoughts about this? It's a really devastating blow for them because he's been there for so long.
And this was a man who, when he first got into politics, people said, oh, he's just a jock. He doesn't really know
anything. Yeah, he wanted to be in the NFL until a bad knee got him out. But, you know, he was very aggressive about the things that he wanted to get done. But unlike some legislative people these days, he knew that you could compromise, and that was not a bad word, and you could get the votes together. That's one of the most significant things he was able to do across a broad spectrum of progressive issues in Maryland.
We're getting a lot of calls from Mark Elrich already, but did you know Speaker Bush? What do you remember about his time in office?
I knew him, you know, peripherally because, you know, we weren't, you know, overly involved as council members with the state legislature, so I had occasion to go down there and lobby and talk to him, but hadn't, you know, worked with him a lot. But I know that he was highly respected by our colleagues.
Montgomery County has the largest delegation to the General Assembly than any other jurisdiction mm-hmm. in the state. So do you have any thoughts of your own as to who the next speaker would be? I was mentioning earlier, Delegate Ludke, is how you say his name correctly? He's the chairman of the Democratic Caucus. He will call the group together to pick the next speaker. Do you have any preferences, or have you heard of any preferences that the Montgomery County delegation would like to see a speaker?
I haven't heard anybody named as a preference, and I would more or less leave it to the folks who've worked down there with their colleagues to figure out who's going to be most effective. and helping them advance their agendas. I think this is the field they know better than I. I ought not to guide them. They should be guiding me.
Well, on to Montgomery County. You were at one point a teacher, then a council member on Tacoma Park City Council, then a longtime lawmaker on the county council. You've never served as an executive, however. How do you think you have settled into your role?
Well, few people serve as executives before they're executive. In fact, pretty much none. I think I've settled in. I think it's been a kind of whirlwind. It has been more of a pressure cooker because of budgetary issues, financial things that we dealt with right away that took a lot of time and energy to get balanced and rebalanced in the changing scenario that came from the state on revenues. So there's been a lot on our plate. And you're doing that on top of making personnel decisions, and you're trying to do a budget that was started by a previous county executive. So this first moment of transition, I find, is it's definitely a challenge, but it's, you know, it's what you got to do. It happens every time you change executives.
You, the biggest thing you have to do is, back on March 15th, I watched the video of your introducing your budget. And you said that you walked in and said that I haven't seen the outside since, you know, you got an office because you had so many meetings. But on a serious note, before we finish the budget, you also noted that was the day of the New Zealand massacre. And you announced that there would be additional police and money for houses of worship, at least for a foreseeable time. Did that actually, in fact, happen? Were you able to put people out?
We had actually... We're looking at funding that before that incident happened. So we've had this ongoing discussion about what it's going to take to make sure our houses of worship are safe in the county. And we were putting forward a proposal independent of that. So I don't want anybody to think that those two things were cause and effect. We're aware this is an issue for a while.
I would like... When you were running for office against Nancy Fleurine and the other candidates, you were criticized endlessly for being anti-business. Your transition committee told you that the county is seen as not that friendly to business and said that you need to articulate a culture of business opportunity. How have you done that?
Well,
You didn't like that description of you to begin with, but... You had to overcome it in any event to get elected, and so now your transition team says you still have to work on it.
So, I mean, I'll still say I'm not anti-business. I have issues with development that doesn't pay for infrastructure. Those are two very different things, and I don't find myself at war with the business community per se. I have big questions about how development goes forward. But what we've tried to do is, I got tired of hearing how bad we were. And I said during the campaign that if I got elected, I was going to set up a committee and we're going to review all of Montgomery County's business practices. What do you encounter in Montgomery County if you want to start a business? What are the code issues people run into if they're trying to renovate a building that was built in the 70s, 80s, and 90s and they want to open a business there? Because people repeatedly say that it's different in the other jurisdictions. So Sidney Katz on the council, I've set him up as the head of the committee. We're going to do a series of first public meetings, and we're taking, private input from businesses, and we've asked them to tell us, what are you dealing with that's different than other jurisdictions? My goal by the end of the year is to introduce a package of legislation that makes us no worse than anybody else.
Got to take a short break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation with Mark Elrich, Montgomery County Executive. If you've called, stay on the line. Dominique Maria Bonesi, thank you for joining us.
Thanks, Kojo.
I'm Kojo Namdi.
Hi, it's Diane. The next meeting of my book club is on Wednesday, May 31st at 1 p.m. Eastern. I'll host a discussion of Mad Honey by Jodi Picco and Jennifer Finney Boylan, followed by a conversation with the authors. Find out more and register at dianereem.org/bookclub.
Welcome back. Our guest is Mark Elrich. He is the County Executive for Montgomery County, Maryland. A quick look back at the state's legislative session, the plan to increase the requirements for Governor Hogan's I-270, 495 expansion plan failed. We've since learned that some 34 homes, four businesses would have to be demolished as part of the plan. In total, around 1,500 properties along both highways would be affected. Is that your understanding, or what's your feeling?
That's my understanding, and I think it's really wrong-headed. I think on I-270, there's a way to add the capacity. The county council has been on record for, I think, at least 8 years supporting two reversible lanes that can be built very quickly. I know, actually, that the state's working on a solution for I-270 that will not require a P3. The Beltway is incredibly challenging.
P3, public-private partnership.
Yeah. Something that can be done with a reasonable amount of money and add additional capacity, which is what we've always argued. The Beltway is a very different animal. And trying to shoehorn in two more lanes is going to be impossible.
And 500,000 daily car vehicles on the 495 and I-270. During the campaign and since then, you've talked about rapid bus opportunities, I think, at least on 270, maybe on 495 also. Why aren't buses at the forefront of trying to get people around rather than new lanes for cars?
Because I think we still have some officials who have a 1950s mindset. And, you know, I tried to point out to people when I testified down there that when the state was looking at the Amazon project and Amazon was insistent that we deal with traffic, and that included access to 355. They were proposing a major investment in at least four bus rapid transit lines and adding a third track to the MARC rail system that would go out to West Virginia. So when they looked at the problem, they had a very creative transit-focused solution. And a year later, when we're talking about the governor's proposal, there's no transit for parts of the very same corridor. The other thing I'll say is, you know, in December, I spoke at a breakfast in Montgomery County, and I said if the governor was really serious, he'd start at the American Legion Bridge, because his plan did not start at the American Legion Bridge. I'll point out that a month later, he announced that they're now going to start their Beltway project at the American Legion Bridge. It made no sense to start at the back of the clog.
Gojo, this report says that if something is not done by 2040, which is like 20 years, that it will take you 43 minutes just to go from College Park to Bethesda. That's 10 miles, 43 minutes. Everything's stopping in Montgomery County if you don't do something about traffic.
Well, many of your constituents want to talk to you about traffic, and here is Marcia in Silver Spring. She wants to talk about a specific part of Silver Spring. Marcia, your turn.
Thank you for taking my phone call. I'm calling today to discuss my concerns about an intersection at 29 and Route 198 in Bucusville. Several years ago, I would say about 10 years ago, the giant moved from the northwest corner to the northeast corner to the northwest. So one by one, the shops in the shopping center on the right started closing. Currently, there are only two stores open, one a restaurant, a family restaurant that a lot of locals.
What do you think the county executive needs to do about this?
Well, I'd like to know what does the county plan on doing it, because I fear that if we were located in Potomac, I don't think it would have gone on for this 10-year stretch. So I'd like to know, what are the plans?
Mark Edwards?
So look, the first major problem is that when Giant moved, they held the lease on the other site, and they will not allow the property owner to lease to another grocery store. Without a grocery store, which is the anchor tenant, they've had an impossible time holding on to the other tenants in the shopping center. I wish I could command Giant to remove their lock on the other lease. We're not able to do that. I've met with the property owners. We've talked about some ideas. I've met with some other investors who have thoughts about what they might be able to do over there. But that lack of a grocery store is a major factor. Every shopping center needs an anchor, and they're struggling in the absence of an anchor. But I'm still talking to people, and I know that state delegates up there have been actively involved in it, and Tom Hucker, who's on the council, has been actively involved. So I haven't given up, and I'm not going to accept the situation, but we're trying to figure out how to solve it.
You submitted next year's budget last month with no new tax increases, but you're getting some criticism for cutting the county's contribution to a fund for retirees' health care benefits. What's the justification for that?
Well, so the council I served on went into that fund, I don't know, 5 out of the last 8 years, and the executive tapped into it as well. And the reason is the fund is actually relatively healthy. And the point of the fund is it's supposed to pay for future benefits. And the goal of having a large pot of money is to try to get to the point where the investment yields every year equal the payouts every year on health care. And we've been making progress and moving in that direction. A couple of years ago, the fund actually performed really well, but that we know that was an exception. But our choice, because the state wrote down our revenues, would have been to take another $40 million in cuts out of this year's budget, another $40 million out of next year's budget. What we decided to do is take the $80 million out of OPEB for FY19, put it into the reserves, because we said we would make the 10% reserves this year, which we did. And in the FY20 budget, we actually started resuming full payments into the OPEB account. So OPEB we're not account. Using it's the it's for the employee benefits, retiree benefits.
We try to speak English.
Yeah. You know, I know that.
You started back in March when you proposed this budget. You talked about all the budget cuts that you had to do and all of that. And your friends at the Washington Post, and I point out the editorial page didn't endorse you, but the editorial page says that this budget, apart from all these other issues that Kodjoe just mentioned, is you just paid back the unions for their support and gave out outlandish raises of up to almost 10% in some cases, less so on others, but that you just larded up the unions as a payback for your election.
So the
your
Post,
response?
Yeah, the Post is in fantasy land. When the recession hit, all the unions took hits on their contracts and didn't have the contracts honored. Since the recession ended, the teachers, which lost two steps, have had both their steps restored. The Post didn't write any editorials about that. This year, in FY19, we're paying back the last step that goes to the teachers starting in January. The Post didn't say anything about the union getting two steps last year, and we're not in any different physical situation than we were last year because, oh, by the way, we went into OPEB last year also. The McGeo union never got any steps back. Fire employees.
No, just say with the McGeo union, that's the largest union, and represents 11,000 employees.
So we gave them one step back out of the three they never got. The other unions have had at least one step given back to them. Not everybody gets 9%. A lot of people have already gotten the steps that they missed. So the people who get the extra step is a small number.
Well, let me ask, without getting too detailed, the Post has a fairly good circulation in Montgomery County and has online, too. What is it between you and the Washington Post editorial page? This is the politics hour, so you can speak freely. It's a fairly important voice in our communities, and it has just been dogged in its criticism of you. Is there some genesis that we don't know?
I wish I knew what the genesis was because I haven't done anything that the previous executive didn't approve. You know, he approved the other steps that unions got back. He approved going into OPEB, which the other executive and other councils approved. And when I did what other people did, suddenly I'm running, you know, this outlandish policy. So, you know, the Post is notoriously anti-labor. You know that. You have a history. I know that too.
I have no comment.
And so the fact that, you know, I don't view labor as the enemy of the people is, you know, something that probably grates them the wrong way. And I've been a big proponent of expecting that the most powerful industry in Montgomery County, the development industry, pay more for infrastructure. And the Post seems to have an allergy to that. So I guess, you know, they've had an allergic reaction for years to a couple things I want to do. But I've, at least as far as this budget went, I didn't do anything that hasn't been pretty normal practice around here.
Derek in Washington, D.C., I think, begs to disagree. Derek, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. Good afternoon, Mr. Ulrich. My question is, I'm a former Montgomery County resident, moved to Washington, D.C., and contemplating moving back to Montgomery County. But on this week, I was able to go with my cousin to the Montgomery County Council and its meeting on Tuesday. where I saw a very impressive sight, and it has a lot of it has to do with the blowback on your desire to cut funding to Montgomery College as well as all special needs personnel. And I just can't find the rationale, because that would be such a death knell to groups, especially the special needs groups who pack the county council. What's your rationale for trying to cut funding to special needs in Montgomery County, which would hurt so bad?
So the only
what specifically is he referring
to? He's talking about that we were proposing for some groups that they not get the full supplement a supplement that allows them to pay above the minimum wage. A report was done as a result of payroll filings by a bunch of the nonprofits that a number of them did not pay the 125% above the minimum wage for which we gave them money last year. And so the feeling was, under the law, if you didn't pay 125%, you were supposed to get no supplement. It wasn't like you can supplement up to 125. You had to do 125. So they hadn't done that. We understand that there apparently was a misunderstanding as to what paying 125% of the minimum wage meant. Some of them thought that you could average overtime, and if the average equaled more than that, they thought they were okay. We're having discussions about this, and we're going to work it out. But we were following what the county law was. In fact, we were being more generous than the county law, because we were going to let them get the amount of money they got last year. If they paid 121% of a supplement, we were going to give them 121% of the supplement. But by the law, we shouldn't be giving them 125 if they weren't going to pay 125.
Speaking of money, the legislature we just talked about briefly made more money available for schools, uh-huh. $53 million for schools operation, and $57 million for school construction. That seems like a lot, but in the world of all the needs for Montgomery County schools, it doesn't sound like much.
Actually, it was pretty good.
It is good. Okay, good.
We're looking at it as it's more than enough to make sure the school budget's fully funded. And that's only part of the construction money. We're expecting a second distribution of construction that's actually going to put us above where we were last year and enable us to do some things that we know the school system wants to do. So I'm kind of optimistic about that.
Because we're challenged for time, I'm going to take two phone calls, one right after the other. So please note what the questions are. Here's Evelyn in Bethesda, Maryland first. Evelyn, your turn.
Hi, thanks so much. I had the opportunity to hear Mr. Eldridge speak at his listening sessions and was pleased to hear that you are interested in not only building affordable housing, but preserving housing for the middle class in Montgomery County. I live in the Wingate neighborhood off Old Georgetown Road, where at least half of our 1950s Cape Cods and Colonials have been torn down and very large homes built that have eliminated the green in the neighborhood and very much destroyed the tree canopy. What are you thinking are some strategies for preserving our lovely homes that are summarily destroyed?
Evelyn, thank you for your call on the issue of housing. On to Roberto in Silver Spring, Maryland. Roberto, your turn.
Yes, thank you. Yes, I wanted to ask Mark, since I served on the board of the housing agency of HOC for about 12 years.
That's HOC,
yes.
Yeah, I've always been concerned about the fact that we have three different agencies dealing with housing. We have HOC that is basically moving away from
what's
public
HOC?
Housing.
Housing and Opportunities Commission.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. And then we have the HCA, which manages the Housing Trust Fund, but it's also in the business of...
What's the HCA?
Yeah,
the Department of Housing and Community Affairs.
Thank you.
Exactly. And then we have HHS that deals with the homeless. Now, what I would like to ask Mark is whether his thought of any way that we can start maybe blending these three agencies, because what we have is really silos. We have HOC shooting in one direction, the HCA in another.
Got it.
HHS.
Don't have a lot of time left. Mark, I'll let you got two issues to respond to.
I'll try to answer two quick questions.
Evelyn at Wingate.
We tried to limit the amount of lot coverage to prevent the tearing down the trees and covering lots entirely with buildings. We have a 30% lot coverage limit. And so I would have to see whether, in fact, those lot covered limits are being respected.
Is that commercial and residential?
No, it's just residential. Okay, so residential. You can't cover more than 30% of your lot with concrete or building. So I would have to see what's being done. We all thought 30% was reasonable because it allowed for decent footprint for a house without turning it into occupying the entire space. As far as HOC and the other agencies go, HOC is different because it's a housing authority. It's not actually totally under the county government, and it gets a lot of its money from outside the county, deals with federal agencies. I wish they were producing more affordable housing. They used to produce more. I don't think we're getting the yield we should be getting. I'll be appointing a deputy housing director, and we're going to put a renewed focus on housing production in the county. Homelessness is a separate and apart issue because dealing with housing for moderate to low-income people is one set of problems and a challenge, but dealing with housing for the homeless who generally have no incomes provides another. So we're going to be looking at some innovative ways of building housing and building it at a price point to the county that it actually will allow us to provide more units for the homeless than we've been currently able to provide.
Okay. Very quickly, I know we don't have a lot of time. Tom Manger has left as the police chief since 2004. Russ Hamill, is that to say his name correctly, right, is the acting chief. What is your status on getting the new police chief appointed?
So we're starting to take applications. We're going to do a series of community meetings. We're going to go through the list, narrow it down to what we think are the most likely candidates, and give the community a chance to, first of all, talk to us about what they want policing to be, period, independent of the candidates, but then have a chance to meet people who want to be the next police chief and ask them questions and, you know, get a feel for whether this is the kind of a police chief you want.
You said Manger set a high bar.
He set a high bar, but, you know, he's retiring because I think this is a difficult time, and he's put in a lot of time in as being a police chief, and we have challenges we still have to deal with. You know, the Robert Wright White incident has inflamed a lot of the community.
Right. Jawando, I say his name correctly, has urged that be a major consideration for the next chief. And Tom Glass has said LGBT issues should be, the chief should be fully modern.
One thing you can rest assured of is that neither Tom Sherwood nor I will be applying for the position, so you don't have to worry about it.
My Twitter button says question authority, so I'm not going to be somebody in authority.
Mark Elrich is the executive of Montgomery County. Thank you so much for joining.
Thank you.
Coming up next, Carrie Delaney. She represents Fairfax and Loudoun County in Virginia's House of Delegates. I'm Kojo Nandi. Welcome back. Joining us in studio is Carrie Delaney. She represents Fairfax and Loudoun County in Virginia's House of Delegates. She's a Democrat up for re-election this year. Thank you so much for joining us.
Kojo, thank you for having me.
Earlier this week, a poll found that Virginia Governor Ralph Northam is less popular in his home state than President Trump, who he positioned himself against in 2017. Governor Northam has a 40% approval rate in Virginia, while President Trump has 44%. Despite that approval rate, 52% of voters think the governor should remain in office. But these days, that doesn't seem like a question many people are asking anymore, Tom.
Well, you know, the governor was everyone was on the verge of resigning back, February 1st or something? These things all run together. But, you know, he decided he would stay and fight, that he didn't think he should resign. And, of course, we had the other two issues with the lieutenant governor and the attorney general. And so this poll shows, you know, this poll from the Christopher Newport University, Rachel Bitterkoffer, is that how you say her name? Willie, that's correct. She's the pollster, Bitterkoffer.
Yep.
23% of the respondents did not know anything about the Northam controversy. 23%. I thought that was stunning.
Well,
Maybe means, the delegate has a view of this poll.
I was about to say, it means that 77% of them knew about it. Delegate, you called for Ralph Northam's resignation the day after his scandal broke. You wrote, quoting here, "The trust of the Virginia people has been tarnished and we must focus on moving forward rather than excusing racist actions." At this point, do you still think Governor Northam should step down?
I do stand by my statement, and I think that, you know, the polls are interesting. Polls can be very telling. They can give us a data point when we're considering, you know, policy and positions on things that matter to our community. But I think our key role as lawmakers, as legislators, and as leaders in the community is to listen and to, at times, defer to those who are most affected by an issue. And the members of the Virginia Legislative Black Caucus called for the governor's resignation. And, you know, I'm not a person of color, so I will never know how deeply those actions hurt our communities of color. So I feel when I have members of that community that I can see how deeply it has hurt them. I can see how affected they are by this and how emotional they were in those days after. And that resolute calling for his resignation, I feel I'm going to follow their leadership on that.
There's an NAACP chapter this weekend that will be demonstrating against the governor when he visits. But he's not the only state official who's embroiled in scandal. Lieutenant Governor Justin Fairfax recently denied the two accusations of sexual assault against him, talked about passing polygraph tests, asking prosecutors in Boston and Durham to investigate the chances his accusers are requesting a public hearing. But before you were a House delegate, you were a rape crisis counselor. What do you think should be done in this situation?
So I did serve as a rape crisis counselor in my career, and because of that, those experiences, you know, I am incredibly supportive of survivors of sexual assault and ensuring that their voices are heard. And I think that, you know, we have a responsibility to ensure that anyone whose voice wants to be heard is heard. That is something that, you know, I am extremely committed to. And I think that, you know, we can both serve due process while supporting survivors of sexual assault at the same time, because we know that we really respect in our country, in our community, the concept that someone is innocent until proven guilty and they have due process. But we also exist in a community where too often people who've been sexually assaulted are silenced. They are met with disbelief. They're accused of lying. They're accused of being somehow responsible. You know, I unfortunately encountered too many occasions where during a line of questioning, you know, why were you out that late? How much did you have to drink? There's a lot of blaming that happens to survivors, and there's very, very little in it for them to come forward to pursue justice. And so I believe that we need to meet survivors with a default state that I believe you, that I'm here to listen to you, you have a voice, and I'm going to believe what you say, because that allows them to even have the ability to come forward. And that in and of itself will then allow due process, because if you have one side being completely silenced, then you're not going to have justice and you're not going to have due process.
What is the due process? Clearly, the lieutenant governor has denied these accusations. He's invited investigations. The Republicans in the leadership of the House, the General Assembly, were offered to have a public hearing and have the public and private to have the two women come and speak to the legislature. The Democrats didn't agree with that. What specifically can, in fact, be done at this moment so that we respect the women who have come public, but also respect the lieutenant governor, but also have some resolution of this? It seems to me now that it's just hanging out there, and very emotional, important, personal issue. What do we do next? What would you do to solve this, to make sure it's fully explored?
Well, so what's been proposed right now is a bipartisan commission that would be formed of the Republicans have proposed, you know, five Democrats and five Republicans to hold a hearing. The concerns that we have with that, and that I know our caucus leader had replied back to suggest that, you know, we might want to explore possibly a third party, looking at what are our options and trying to determine the answer to what is the best path forward, because I think what we want to avoid is anything that's even remotely political, and certainly anything that could do more damage. When we don't know if there are investigations that are happening in other states right now, we don't know if there are the possibility of a criminal case being opened in another location. Anything that we do in Virginia could tamper with that process.
Very quickly, have you called for the lieutenant governor to resign?
Yes, I have.
Okay. You're running for re-election right now. We do have to give you this opportunity to tell your constituents why they should re-elect you.
She's running unopposed in the primary, so that says something.
That's not a reason to re-elect her, though.
Well, you know, during my campaign, I feel like the heart of my campaign was putting people before politics. And that is something that I'm really proud that I feel like I was able to not only make the promises of delivering those kind of results, but then actually fulfill those promises down in Richmond. And I think we accomplished a lot of really great things. I feel very proud of the bills that I passed in my first 2 years down in Richmond. And I think that, that's what I'm hearing the most from people. When I'm out on doors and I'm talking to folks at town halls and office hours, they want to know, what have you done for me? What problems have you fixed? What solutions have you delivered? And I think we've made some really great headway. This past session, one of the bills that, especially as someone who's been a child advocate in my professional career, one of the bills I'm most proud of is a bill that we passed that will now become law that will require all members of clergy to report child abuse. They'll be required mandatory reporters for cases of child abuse and neglect.
Even if that's heard in a confessional?
There is an exemption for confessions. And okay. What I'll say to that is I think that, that really allowed the bill to get out of the House and the Senate unopposed. And when we had our testimony for that bill, when that bill was up in the committee, we had a line of folks that came from all over to speak to how the bill would have helped them in their situation had that been law, when they had whatever their experience may have been. And none of those events took place in a confessional. So we know that that's not really where cases of child abuse are becoming known. They are becoming known in other scenarios where we know that if our members of clergy are required to report that abuse, I think we could save a lot of children.
And here's Dan in Fairfax, Virginia. Dan, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hi there. Thanks so much for taking my call. I'm a constituent of the delegates, and I just have a quick question that I think transcends partisan lines. That's money in politics. I know that a lot of delegates and state Senate candidates across the Commonwealth are gaining a lot of attention, even in conservative areas, and support for opposing corporate money, including Dominion. And I don't believe the delegate has done that, including Dominion Electric. So I heard her talk about putting people before politics, and I just think this is a great example of being able to sort of walk the walk on that issue. Thank you.
You were once a registered Republican. You've said that in the past. You've shared different viewpoints on different issues, and that your views have evolved. Have your views on this issue evolved?
And you spoke about this Wednesday. I watched a video of you at a town hall with John Bell, and you said that it's ridiculous how so much money is in legislative races. Bell said you have to raise $1 million, or he did. Mm-hmm. Where are you on money and from special interest?
Yeah, it is ridiculous how much money these races cost. And I think we do need to get the money out of politics. And, having spent a term down in Richmond, I absolutely believe that we need comprehensive campaign finance reform. I have made the decision to not take money from Dominion Energy. I think that there was legislation that we saw that unfortunately did not pass this past session that would have actually prohibited candidates from taking money from those types of regulated entities. And I think that this is an important issue that I think has really come to the forefront in the past couple of years, of how those relationships and what message that sends to people. And so I have definitely listened to the community on that issue and think we need comprehensive campaign finance reform.
We have just a quick moment. Kodjo mentioned you're a former Republican. You were on the Melbourne City Council, appointed as a Republican. You didn't win an election. When was that, and when did you come to Northern Virginia? Maybe a lot of our listeners don't know that much about you.
Sure. So that was actually the West Melbourne City Council, an even smaller town. And my husband and I moved out there shortly after graduating from college at the University of South Florida. And had our first few post-college years there. And, you know, I started getting involved in local government at that point.
So, but when did you move here?
Moved to the area in 2006.
Okay.
Yeah.
You don't get much more local than Rhodes. So here's Lisa in Baltimore. Lisa, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Yes, hi. Yeah, it is very local. I'd love to see Richmond get more involved in large, looking at the whole area as one piece. We live in Western Loudoun. You can't get to Eastern Loudoun, let alone Fairfax, Arlington, any jobs at all. The roads are all completely clogged. We cannot telework because we don't have high-speed internet. Can't get that either. So unless the government start working together and figuring out how to make this a cohesive work and life environment, we are all in big trouble, especially in Loudoun. But it's turned out where this building boom and economic boom is just putting more and more houses.
Delegate Delaney, we're running out of time rapidly.
Lisa, I agree with you completely. I think that is the unifying issue. It doesn't matter one's political party. We all equally despise the traffic in Northern Virginia. And, you know, I'm committed to really continuing to work for multimodal solutions. You know, we need to make investments in metro. We need to make investments in our arterial roadways. But we do need to make investments in things like broadband, rural broadband, and incentivizing more telework, because we have to create solutions that work for different people in different ways so that congestion can be spread and relieved in a variety of ways. And so I think a multimodal, comprehensive approach is that's what I ran on, that's what I've been pushing for down in Richmond, and what I'll continue to push for.
Got a minute left, huh?
Any progress in Richmond for that? Your district is between Reston and Centerville along Highway 50, 66, which is a parking lot. Is there specific legislation passed this past year or you hope to pass next year to ease traffic issues?
Well, one thing that we were able to pass this year was a bill that that primarily gets funding for I-81. But in those negotiations, we were able to secure the return of about $20 million to our local transportation fund that will fund arterial roadways. Unfortunately, some of those local roadway money was lost the prior session in a bill that I did not support, in a vote that I was opposed to. And my mission has been to get that money back so that we can both invest in Metro while ensuring that we have the necessary funds to build out our arterial roads and relieve congestion.
Carrie Delaney represents Fairfax and Loudoun County in Virginia's House of Delegates. She's a Democrat up for re-election this year. Governor McAuliffe has endorsed your campaign. He's thinking of running for president. Are you going to endorse him if he does?
There's a lot of folks running for president, and I'm looking forward to hearing all of their platforms, but I think we've got some great folks in the field, and I'm looking forward to that.
Thank
but first,
you.
We got to get through 2019 and flip the House of Delegates.
Thank you for joining us. Today's Politics Hour was produced by Ruth Tam. Tomorrow is D.C. Emancipation Day, marking the D.C. Compensated Emancipation Act of 1862, which ended slavery in D.C. and freed 3,100 slaves. There will be a parade and a concert, fireworks at Freedom Plaza. Coming up Monday, in the two decades since the Columbine shooting, states have introduced laws to keep schools safe from gun violence. We look at how Maryland legislators have handled the issue and what local schools are doing to prevent a mass shooting. Plus, we hear from the Georgetown University, where students just voted to create a fund to benefit the descendants of people enslaved by the school. That all starts Monday at noon. Until then, Tom Sherwood, have a great weekend. Thank you all for listening. I'm Kodjo Nandi.
Thanks for listening to The Kodjo Nnamdi Show, and if you're already a member of WAMU 88.5, thank you for your support. If not, it's easy to give online at wamu.org. Just click the donate button, and thanks.